Welcome to episode 10 of International Clearance with your hosts, myself, Scully, and Joe Walker, the voice you can hear there.
Hey, here we are. Look at us now. 10 in.
Flying through, man. We're flying through.
Yeah. 10 episodes was our target because the thought of any more at that point in terms of getting guests sorted in advance just felt so daunting. Mm-hmm. Now that we're here, how do we reflect on that? Is that still how we're thinking?
I don't know. It's a weird one because I think you're way more happy to be structured with it, right? So you're like, we're going to do 10 episodes and we'll break and we'll come back and we'll do another 10. And I would just thought, just do it. So we have not enough left to interview at that moment in time. Then we'll break for a bit because not even just everyone being outside, but football in terms of the Euros, international duty will be on. And a lot of people that we would speak to would get called up for international duty. Then I was just like, yeah, the summer will be long in terms of like preseason and that. And we'll just go again when we're ready. So in terms of number, I never had a specific number. I just know this podcast has loads of legs and can continue essentially indefinitely because there's always new football players in different countries.
It does, but I'm tired. This has taken over my life.
Yes, yes, yes. I think you have earned a well-deserved break.
Yeah, spinning many plates at the moment. I thought, let me just do a block of 10, but I'll see how I feel because I have been enjoying it. And as you say, there's definitely more potential. I just set myself up for a fall with some of this, doing the weekly thing. Especially because as we might have mentioned on here before, we couldn't bank that many in advance because people just didn't know what they were dealing with. It was only once we went live that people were willing to get on board a lot more.
So well, until then, it was just an idea, right? So it was like we did 3 or 4 and people were like, oh, okay, like this is, it exists. Like we'd like to have voice for it. But like you're saying, as long as there's no tangible product you can see, we're essentially saying, hey, do you want to talk to us for an hour or two? And yeah, we're going to put it out and you have no idea where we're going to put it out or how it's going to sound. And like, if you're used to, especially you have to remember how people in general, but football players especially, how they're treated by the media. That is a very risky place to be in. Oh, what? So we're just going to talk for hours and you're just going to do what with it? So, yeah, I think we need a proof of concept to be able to run up to at least 10.
Yeah. Which I think we've got now.
Yeah, we definitely do have that now. And I think it means that it'll live a lot longer. I'm excited for season 2, even though we don't know when season 2 is coming. Yeah. This isn't even definitely the end of season 1. Yeah, we're not necessarily saying that, but you know, we have ticked off a bucket list one with this one, definitely. However, before we get to that, let's talk about last week's episode.
Yeah, we had Cam Mellon, who runs the English Players Abroad social media account. He was our special guest last week. We normally do a Tuesday teaser for each episode, the day before episode lands on our social media at INTL Clearance. At INTL Clearance, we put a little passport page full of stamps of the clubs that our guest has played or coached for. Cam, obviously not being a footballer, it was a blank page and we thought that might be difficult. We dropped a little bit of a hint, a smidgen of a hint on the tweets and the Instagram posts, just the kind of hint that the guest had been mentioned in shows before. So salute to Ash Civil, who took that hint and correctly assumed that it was Cam Mellon. Well done, Ash Civil. That's probably one of the hardest ones we'll do, blank page.
Yeah, well done that you guessed it, honestly. I'm a little bit surprised.
Scully's mentioned it's quite a big episode today, so we're going to fly through some updates before we get to our guest. And top of the bill, into Miami, they've come up again. This is the David Beckham franchise in MLS. They have appointed Phil Neville as manager. Ryan Shawcross has just joined them. And joining them in the summer is another Brit, another Englishman, in fact. Kieran Gibbs will be leaving West Bromwich Albion at the end of the season to join Inter Miami. Now, Scully, you're an Arsenal fan, and Kieran Gibbs is perhaps best known for his time at Arsenal, even though he hasn't been there for quite some time. Were you as surprised as I was to learn that Kieran Gibbs is still only 31?
Yes and no. That guy's drinking from the fountain of youth. I am surprised to hear he's 31, but when I think about it, it makes sense. He's definitely been at Arsenal since I was like in primary school, maybe.
Well, that's my point. I guess he started so young at Arsenal because the way his career has panned out, I thought he's on this like he's about to retire. And when I guess he is going to Inter Miami, but 31 is still like If he wants, there's still like another decade of football there. But Inter Miami's not a bad gig. His time at West Brom hasn't been the best. I mean, they got promoted back to the Premier League, but I don't think he's in the starting lineup every week. Certainly not under Sam Allardyce. So yeah, if you don't think your contract's going to get renewed because they get relegated, I imagine he's on Premier League wages. Mm-hmm. They could cope last time, but not this time. Inter Miami's not a bad net to land on.
Without being disrespectful to the level of MLS, I think years of Premier League experience means that Kieran can go to Inter Miami and get a good few years out and kind of give that team some of his wisdom and experience that he's garnered over the years.
You'd hope so. If the desire is still there, then there's no reason why that can't happen. On to another update. A player who feels old, but unlike Kieran Gibbs, is actually a lot older. To be fair, I was surprised he was this young because he's been out of the game for so long. Titus Bramble.
This one was crazy.
Former Ipswich, former Newcastle, Wigan. Titus Bramble hasn't played professional football since 2013.
Oh, wow.
If you think about how long ago that was, that is eight years ago. That means that Titus Bramble hasn't played since he was like 31, 32. He left Sunderland in 2013. And an insane way to just cut off from football completely.
It's a very big gap, but you know what it is? Yeah. When you're a bagsman. Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know what it is, actually. What is going on there? There is questions that need to be asked.
So there was, around the last couple of years of his time at Sunderland, he had a few court cases. There was a drugs case. There was also a sexual assault case as well, with which he was released without charge. But obviously, it was a bit of a storm there at Sunderland. Sunderland, I mean, I'm shooting at the wind here, but I imagine Sunderland was struggling at that time. And so, you know, it's a safe bet.
Just guessing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think they must have let him go. And it's easily possible that he fell out of love of football at that point. Just looking here, he went back to Ipswich on trial after he left Sunderland at like 31, 32 and wasn't offered a contract. Later in his career, he was an under-11s coach at Ipswich. So yeah, I think he's just been kicking on and just getting on with it. And, you know, he might have accumulated some wealth and business opportunities in his time where he didn't feel like playing for much longer. He might have fallen out of love of the game.
I mean, he did make an appearance for Stowmarket Town in 2017.
As a player coach of Stowmarket Town. But yeah, that's a hint that he tried to get back in maybe. Probably at that point was like, why am I playing at this level? Which I think is a reasonable question. I understand that. But something that suggests he has got his love for the game back a little bit while he still can. He signed for Safa FC, who are in the second tier of the Dubai Amateur League. Dubai Amateur League suggests that he's not being paid. He's just doing it for the love. They're a non-profit expat football club. So it's a team for expats, which makes some sense.
Yes, yeah, that does actually make a lot of sense now. Wow.
Yeah, I think this is just for Titus to keep fit and have a laugh, maybe playing with his mates or something. This isn't a money grab. This isn't a attempt to have one last stab at the top level. This is someone just enjoying his football. But it's nice to know that he is out there still. Because leaving the game that early, or at least certainly at a playing level, I would always take that to assume that he'd fallen out of love with the game. So any hint that that's changed is a good thing, I think.
These things do ebb and flow. And yeah, why not just have a bit of a kick about and enjoy your time with the game that you love?
Are you still fit to play it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving on to someone else who might not feel very in love with the game right now. Terry Fenwick. What do you know about Terry Fenwick, Scully?
Not enough.
I only knew him because he was a coach at Crystal Palace once upon a time. But he was, in his time, an England international, played for Spurs. He played in the 1986 World Cup for England. I think he's part of that group of players that fails to chase Maradona down for that infamous goal.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I think he might have even elbowed Maradona in that game as well, which is why a lot
That adds context to what you're about to say next.
Fast forward to 2021, Terry Fenwick is manager of Trinidad and Tobago. You know, it's international break coming, but he's not in the news quite for the right reasons. He's denied accusations that he headbutted the Trinidad and Tobago press officer. So a video leaked online of a very vicious row during a training session. And reports then after say that, no, it's not in the footage, but they then got into a physical altercation. There's been an official statement from the Trinidad FA. The matter has been resolved, greatly exaggerated, all of that usual stuff. But I'm not being funny. Nothing says hiding guilt like being asked about it at a press conference, where I imagine that the press officer was standing there, arms crossed, maybe kissing his teeth. Terry Phillips' response to being asked was, don't even go there. It's all rubbish and you'll recognise all the areas it is coming from. Now, I'm not being funny. If you're being rumoured to have had a fight with someone and there's footage being leaked of you having a ferocious row with this guy, by the way, I don't think your response is to go, don't even go there. Don't look. Don't even go there. As if you wouldn't be asked about it. That's not a reasonable inquiry. You're being very chippy there, Terry. I mean, you spoke, enjoy yourself. You're managing Trinidad and Tobago. And then when your day's done, you're enjoying that Caribbean sun. What is your problem? What are you so angry about? Just chill out a bit, Terry. All right? Enjoy yourself. Remember, you've only got one life and you're in Trinidad and Tobago. We're very jealous of that. So go enjoy that. And speaking of enjoying your one life, on to today's guest.
Oh, mate.
I feel like this is a reward for the day one listeners.
The day ones. Riding from us from the off.
Because one of our first episodes that we had, the conversation that Scully and I had was about dream moves going abroad and the greatest places to play.
I'm pretty sure it was episode one. So if you haven't, if you've just joined this podcast at late dates, please go back to episode one and listen.
Because, or the team that I put forward to, that was a dream to play for, Team Hawaii. And an American franchise that Scully was so disbelieving of and so suspicious of. They only functioned for 1 year, 1977. And were made up quite a lot of English players that went over on loan.
Owned, by the way, by the son of the owner of infamous crisp potato chip company Lay's in America. Yeah. I'm sorry. This is all spelling out tax write-off to me.
Yeah. So it's something we've had an eye on and we always thought, you know, it would be great if we could speak to someone who played for Team Hawaii that from the UK. Now, that presented a few challenges. A lot of these guys are in their early to mid 70s, but we did it. We did find someone. It took a lot of favors from other people around this person because, you know, people in their 70s, they don't have much of a social media digital presence, generally speaking, not in a way that we do. And so I'm just very glad that we got to do it. Our guest today is our first Scottish guest, finally. But the fact that that's our first milestone for a Scottish player, that's not the story here.
Not at all.
This guest, we've had guests before who have played the majority of their career abroad. You look at Richard Offiong or Brenton Mohammed. But I believe this is our first guest thus far. I mean, it's to be continued with a Brenton Mohammed, for example. But this guest is the first we've spoken to who stayed out there, created a whole new life for themselves and hasn't called the UK home for, well, in this case, several decades.
Yeah, a very long time.
This guy had a career in the North American Soccer League, teams in the US and Canada, played in New York, played and managed in Tulsa. But most importantly, he was a player and then player coach at Team Hawaii. We hit the lottery, Scully.
We did it.
Player manager.
What's that Kamala Harris said? We did it, Joe.
We did it.
This is a moment they have all been waiting for. First and foremost, let me not say too much, but as Joe said, I was very, very apprehensive about the idea or even the true existence of Team Hawaii before this interview. But we learn a lot about just American soccer culture and kind of how it's developed as well. Like the America he was playing in compared to America that exists today is different, but he was part of the journey.
Yeah, we've had America come up a few times and I imagine they will come up again. But it's been about MLS or the college system in recent history. Our guest today is Charlie Mitchell, who played at the very sort of, it's almost the inception of the NASL in the late 60s, early 70s. And he ended up staying his whole career there. And it's our insight into the American soccer history that they really tried to make it work at the time. Financially, in the end, it didn't quite take off, which is why, I mean, even I think the way it worked in the States, I believe they agreed to create the MLS in order to get the USA 94 World Cup. I think it was one of the conditions to get it was the fact that you guys don't have a professional league anymore. If you're going to do this, you need to show that you know, you're going to have some legacy from this tournament. But yeah, this guest is easily our oldest guest, 72 years old. obviously not having much communication with him beforehand was slightly apprehensive about, you didn't know where, how this would go. Let me tell you guys, it was an absolute dream of a conversation.
Breeze. It was actually a breeze. It was actually the first time in so long where I was like, we could have talked for 3 hours. Mm. Great person to speak to. Really, really like kind of gave some great insight to his life. And when you listen to his life, it is genuinely the stuff of movies.
Mm.
Like some of the players he played with, the places he'd been, the lifestyle he was living.
Mm.
It was top tier stuff. We look at people like, so for my generation, it's like a David Beckham.
Mm.
And like, I guess for my little brothers who are like, you know, 10, 13, 17 type age, they look at like, you know, obviously Ronaldo, Messi, but then there's like Sancho is the new guy. And all these guys are new guys who are doing lifestyle, but footballers. Yeah.
Mm.
This guy was lifestyle, bro. Like when you listen to his story, it's actually, wow, you lived like this.
But doing it as somebody whose name doesn't ring bells in the UK.
Yeah.
It was just like this secret life that he was living and having a great time. But yeah, as Scully mentioned, played with a few big players, Pele being the massive obvious one, but also Peter Lorimer, who has passed away since the recording, speaks about the late Peter Lorimer, Leeds legend, very, very fondly in this as well, having played with him in Toronto. But yeah, without further ado, let's get into it because it's a very enjoyable conversation that we had with him. This is us speaking with Charlie Mitchell. Charlie, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, thank you. Thanks for having me on your program.
No, of course, of course. Whereabouts are you at the moment, Charlie?
I'm in Sarasota, Florida.
Oh, lovely. Wow. How long have you been based out in Florida?
We retired in December and moved down here the late part of December. So we're Floridians for 2 months.
I'll let you in a secret, Charlie. It's Joe's dream place to retire because he's obsessed with alligators.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of gators. So I might visit you 1 year.
Well, I tell you, you're more than welcome. All you have to do is go on the golf course here and you see them on the golf courses. It's for me, it's frightening.
I'm sure.
I can run faster than the alligator, I hope.
Hopefully, yeah. Keep a buggy nearby just in case. Keep it safe. Now, Charlie, let's take you back to the late 1960s. You've played for St Mirren up in Scotland, where you're from.
Right.
But how does that move to Rochester come together?
It's a bit of a magic deal. A pal of mine, his name was Johnny Kerr, and he played for Partick Thistle. We were both apprentices. He was an apprentice at Partick, and I was an apprentice at St Mirren. And he came over to Rochester for the summer and played there. And he came back and told me, in the off-season, I think I can get you fixed up in Rochester. So the following year, I asked the manager, St Mirren, could I go play in the off-season? And he was pleased to let me go. So I came over and played for Rochester in 1969. And it was like, I know you boys can appreciate this. I was just an average player in Paisley, Scotland, you know. Mm. And I went through the apprenticeship program. And it was, you know, wash your shirts and clean the boots and all the stuff that, you know, the footballers don't really realize what you had to do. When I came to Rochester, I was kind of like the main man. You know, I was, between the, being a footballer and actually, you know, just the way I was well appreciated and I was taken in by the crowd and by the family and by the team. So the following year, I went back and I asked the manager, could I go back again? And I started to talk to the rest of the players about how good it was in America. And he came back to me. He says, Charlie, you better get out of here. He said, because I'm going to lose half the team. So I was so impressed by how things were in America, how much that my personal relationship was. I was enjoying it. I was getting well recognized. And I was playing good football. So, and there was a lot of good players that came from Great Britain and other countries. So I was learning about different styles of play with the South Americans and, you know, the other players that were in amongst the Rochester team at that time.
That first season there you mentioned, 1969, in the summer, they're still in what was, I guess, the ASL at that point, the American Soccer League. Was there a noticeable difference in interest, investment, whatever you want to call it, the following season when you then went back, it was in the NASL?
Correct. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to come back because they'd moved up into the North American Soccer League, which was the number one Premier League at that particular time. Mm. So, and having won the the ESL thing promoted us into that with Washington. So it was a lure for us to come over. And it was a good standard of football, as far as I was concerned, which is very important. That, and you were playing in a really nice stadium. So it was a good move, as far as I was concerned.
How was New York State treating you at that time, at that age? What was that like to move over there on your own?
Well, it was exciting because, you know, you've heard all the rumours, but they're all probably true. They gave us an apartment. They gave me a car, I mean, a leased car. You know, the actual intrinsic value, there wasn't a lot of money. I get $100 a game.
Right.
But it's all that you got on the side. And then you get invited to other people's house for dinner, or people invite you out for dinner. It was a whole different prospect of what I was used in Paisley, Scotland. You know, this is, it was Hollywood.
Yeah.
We above Hollywood, you know, compared to being in Paisley, Scotland. It was a big step up. But I didn't want to tell too many people that. You don't want to sound like you're bragging or you're
sure boasting. Fair enough. One thing that I wanted to ask about, if it took some getting used to with the point system, as I've come to look it up, things like 6 points for a win and a point per goal up to a certain limit. Did that take any getting used to, particularly as a defender?
You know, the funny thing was I didn't worry about it. I just wanted to win the games and then just tell me at the end of the game, what did we get? Three English or 3 points for every point for a goal up to three. So I wasn't really concerned about that at that time. My main concern is obviously like most footballers, I just wanted to win the game and move up the table. So I'm being honest with you, I wasn't too involved with all that.
You seem to have a good time as well. I mean, in 1970, yeah, that debut inaugural season in the NASL, the Lancers win the league. But you win the playoffs and therefore the championship, more importantly. So you just must have been a whirlwind at that point because it's all still very new, of course.
It was fantastic. The manager that came on board made me the captain of the team. I like to think it's because I was the best defender, but I think it's because I had the biggest mouth. and having a Scotch tongue, I wasn't afraid to talk up, and even with some of the South American players. So it was huge. It was huge. You know, we took a private jet down to Washington to play that final game where we actually lost the game, but we won in aggregate. And then when we come back, the airport in Rochester was full of fans. You know, right. And we walked and we had the trophy in one hand and holding up the trophy and stuff like that. So you can just imagine it was a magic experience. And I had no idea we were going to win it, but we had a good team and it was very comparable. But it was, I guess it was kind of off the cuff, the first year in the league, and we won the championship. And that allowed us to do other things, but winning the championship allowed us to go into the CONCACAF, and we qualified for CONCACAF tournament.
Oh, amazing.
It took us down to Guatemala. So once again, a lead boy from Paisley ends up in Guatemala. Talk about that.
Hey.
What was it like playing football in Guatemala? Did you find it difficult adjusting to the heat?
It wasn't as hot as I can remember back then. I couldn't remember, but it was the food. The food for us British boys, you know, it wasn't what we were looking for. We saw the stuff in the market. There was flies all over the food in the market, so we didn't want to eat the food. I think I ate bananas and cereal for a week, so I missed the food, put it that way.
How's the public reaction to that Rochester success? You mentioned the ovation at the airport, but generally speaking, would let's say you were walking around Rochester at the time, would you be recognized fairly often? Was it that sort of experience living there?
Yeah, it was. I mean, Rochester wasn't that big a city, and they were getting something like 6,000 to 10,000 people a game, but the local news and the sportscasters, they were always talking to you, so you were kind of well known through because of the television more than the
right.
The name. We were invited on morning shows to go talk in a morning show and then maybe in an evening show. So we got our exposure, and I got my exposure mostly through the television. And then people would recognize you if you went out for a dinner or if you stopped by for a drink someplace or something like that.
Now, you do quite a few seasons at Rochester. You don't win another championship, but you do win the league another time. And what leads to the move to the New York Cosmos then about 5-6 years later?
Well, the manager at that time was a guy called Gordon Bradley. He was a player coach for New York. And I always played well against New York for some reason. And I think Gordon kind of remembered me all the time. So when a guy called Ken Furphy was at Sheffield United, he got the position of the manager's job at New York in 1976. And Pele came there in 75, and Gordon Bradley, he brought Pele to New York. So when Keith Furphy got to New York, they were looking for a left back. And Gordon Bradley recommended me to Keith Furphy, who, you know, who didn't know me from Adam, but he took Gordon Bradley's recommendation and called me up and said, would you like to join me in New York? And I says, make it happen. So, and you talk about Hollywood, that was Hollywood.
Right.
The Cosmos were owned by Warner Communications.
Right.
So I had to fly down to New York and meet them at Warner Brothers. And back, I know you're laughing here. I hope Scully's laughing as well. A wee boy from Paisley has been up to Warner Brothers, and Rod Stewart was actually there at that particular time having dinner when I had to go in for lunch with these guys, and Rod Stewart was sitting there at that particular... That was the kind of environment. So do you think I'm walking around there? I mean, I'm walking in the sky, but I wasn't showing it. I was acting the big boy, but inside, I was like, what the hell's happening here? What is this for real? So this gives you a perspective that Warner Brothers really, really took the Cosmos to a whole new level.
Yeah. And I guess New York City as a place to be, even though you're in the same state as Rochester, I guess that alone, never mind the Warner Brothers affiliation, must have just been a whole different kettle of fish.
No, it's a whole different... I mean, New York, I mean, we're up upstate New York. We were 4 hours drive away from an hour's plane flight. So it was nothing. New York is just... it was unbelievable. I knew it was like, you know, we had Joe Namath there, was at the training camp. It was just, the whole thing was it was just magic. And all the British players that came in were some really good British players. Keith Furphy's, I told you, he was the manager of Sheffield United. So when he got the job, he brought three or four players from Sheffield who actually ended up palling up with. That was easy for me to mold in with these boys, along with the South Americans and obviously Pelé. And then it was George Canaglia, and then it was Beckenbauer. So it was a whole new world.
Yeah. That really is Hollywood football.
Yeah.
Some big names listed there.
It really was, you know. You just had to keep pinching yourself every now and again. But the secret is you don't want to show it. You know, you're still trying to make sure that...
You look like them. You belong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was part of the... But I'm telling you, and I think, you know, you can tell in the back of my mind, I'm like, This is Hollywood. I better behave myself here, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Funny you mentioned behaving yourself, actually. Given the huge furor around Pelé in that situation, did you find that he was kind of allowed to come and go as he pleased? Was he very disciplined in training, or did he just not turn up certain days? How did that work?
That's a magic question. Joe, I'm telling you, he was first class. And you can take it from the horse's mouth right now. He'd come to training in a limo, because he lived in New York City, so the limo driver would bring him to training. He changed in the dressing room with the boys. Obviously, he talked to South American boys and stuff like that. He'd smile all the time at us. On the training field, he would do everything that we had to do, and even sometimes he would stay behind and do some more stuff, and encourage people like myself to stay behind and do some more stuff as well. So there was no question about his dedication. He didn't act like a superstar. He didn't ask for fly first class. He flew with the boys, which I'm sure he could have flown first class. There was always one thing that I can remember, and you might find this kind of interesting. When the game was over, we all go back up when the stadium, we'd get back in the team bus where we're going back to, and we would all be sitting in the team bus, and obviously the media wanted to talk to Pelé. And we might have to wait 15, 20 minutes or so on the bus waiting for Pelé. He would walk on the bus, and he broke an English accent. He would apologize. He'd say, I'm sorry for keeping you here, but this is why I came to America, to try and promote the sport. So thank you for waiting for me, and I am sorry. He did that in a kind of broken English accent. And I always thought that was a class act.
Definitely.
In that season there with the Cosmos, you played at the Yankee Stadium. Now, the attendances would vary wildly depending on who you were playing. What was the biggest crowd you can remember playing in front of then?
That's an easy one, Joe. We played against Los Angeles Aztecs, and it was Pelé against Bestie. George Best was playing it for Los Angeles Aztecs at that time. Bestie didn't call it the New York Cosmos and the Los Angeles Aztecs. They called it Pelé and Bestie. I think there was something like 40 or 50,000 people at that game.
Wow.
And that was I played in the game marking Bestie, but that was the biggest game.
Was that part of your league game, or was that an exhibition? What was the setup with that?
No, that was the league game. We played them in Los Angeles, and we played them at the Yankee Stadium. We played them twice.
And speaking of exhibition games, because Pelé was there, was that quite a common thing to happen in that period?
Well, I remember we played against Dallas down in New Orleans. This is an exhibition game to try and promote the game down in New Orleans. And we played a couple of games in Florida against Fort Lauderdale. But at the end of the year, we went on a world tour and we went to Japan, Belgium, Holland. That was the end of the season deal. We played against the Japanese national team. We played against Paris Saint-Germain in Paris. And then I can't remember who we played in Belgium. But that was another, I mean, it was just a whirlwind, you know.
You're playing for essentially like the Harlem Globetrotters at that point.
Yeah,
that's what it was like, you know. And in all fairness to us British boys, we were just loving it. I mean, the hotel accommodations were first class. You know, you didn't have to worry about sending your name for a meal or anything like that. It's the way it was supposed to be. It was all because of Pelé.
It was just that one season with the Cosmos, because you get to the one we've been looking forward to talking to you about, Charlie, which
infamous, much anticipated.
A trade to Team Hawaii, a new franchise in 1977. When that offer's put to you, that was that a difficult decision? Did you need much thinking?
No, because, you know, I can give you another name. Charlie Aitken came over, a premier player in England. Well, he came over and he took over the left-back position. So I was sitting on the bench. And then Furphy got fired or got the bullet, whatever you want to call it. So I was in a position where I wanted to play. So they called me up and said, it was a German coach who used to coach for the Boston team. And they said that Hubert Vogelsanger was interested in buying your contract in Hawaii. And I must admit, there was, you know, I'm in New York and I knew where Hawaii was. And I just said, I'm in. And they're going to pay you the same contract. They're going to give you an apartment. They're going to give you a car. I mean, I was like, yeah, okay. You know, I wasn't even, what are you supposed to say? No. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny me talking to you about this, boys, but it's all coming back to me. It was like a freaking fairy tale. You know what I mean? Yeah. I must be just doing the right thing. But let me go give you some advice to any younger players that are listening. I must admit, I know I was a good professional. You know, I trained hard, played hard, I took care of my body. So, you know, I was getting rewarded for doing the business. That's me kind of bottom line. I'm making it sound that, but they wouldn't have wanted me unless I could have been an asset.
Yeah, because you were captain on when you went there as well.
Vogelsanger made me the skipper as well. Because of my outstanding soccer ability or my Scottish mouth, you can pick whichever one you want.
Hey, it doesn't have to be one or the other, Charlie. It can be both.
Combination of both, yeah, most definitely. And yeah, I have to say, you are played in some dream locations. You are, like, it's great to be a footballer anyway, right? Like, a lot of kids dream of being a footballer when they grow up. But if you were to tell my younger brother, if I was to call my younger brother and be like, you can be a footballer and you go and play in New York and you play against Paris Saint-Germain and you can play against the Japanese national team and then you can get sold to Hawaii, he would tell me I'm having a laugh. You might know one's had a career like that.
I'm proof of the pudding. I know. That's why I'm laughing myself, because when I start thinking about it, sometimes you don't appreciate things at the time and it takes a while for it to sink in. So now I'm talking to you boys again. It's starting to sink in some more that I was very fortunate.
Team Hawaii, how receiving and welcoming were the islands to this soccer team being set up?
Well, you know, surprisingly, they had a good football league over there. They had a lot of people playing soccer. In high school, they had soccer. There were a lot of men's teams. Some of the, you know, the Hawaiian boys, I call them the Hawaiian guys, a lot of them were into the soccer. They weren't into American football or anything like that. So there was quite a few amateur soccer teams there. And the team was owned by Ward Lay, which was Lay's Potato Chips. Mm-hmm. Dad was Herman Lay, who was a real potato chip guy.
Yeah.
So we had good backing. And unfortunately, we didn't get the crowds that we'd hoped we were going to get. We got a good crowd when maybe a boat was in, like a boat came in from the mainland or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was mostly tourists and local people that came to the games. And the field was kind of weird. I don't know if you've read up on that, but it was a baseball field, but the stadium could move on wheels, electronically in wheels, to turn it into a football field.
Wow.
So it wasn't really, we played at Aloha Stadium, which is the big stadium there. It wasn't really set up for football, or we say soccer, whatever word you want to use. Mm. But people that did show up were so enthusiastic. At that time, I thought it's going to take a couple of years to build up a crowd here, but I thought it would happen because the media was right behind us. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to report. The sports media, they had nothing else but the soccer. You know, there was no football, there was no tennis, there was no hockey, there was no nothing. So we were it, basically. And they responded well to us and gave us a lot of media time. And you must remember, these days they televised every game. All the games were televised back to the mainland and back again. That was the biggest thing was that for us was when we made a trip to the mainland, we played four or five games. But the thing that the league didn't like, when the away teams came to us, they had to fly all that way for just one game.
Right.
And we took it. We thought it was to our advantage because, you know, it's going to take you 5 hours just from LA. So if you were coming from New York, it's going to be a 10-hour flight.
So you'd be jet lagged, tired. Definitely your advantage.
Right. All the players had all the excuses. Because when the players would come, I know you boys are going to laugh at us, but most of the teams that come in, I knew players from the other team, and you could see all the tongue wagging I was getting. How did you get here? What the hell? How did this happen? You know, it was like, you know, well, you just, you know, get lucky. But it was funny. Some of my mates would come in and I just kind of rubbed their nose in it a little bit.
You mentioned there some of the logistics. So when you would go for away games, as you mentioned there, you would knock out four or five games at a time on the mainland. What kind of time span would that be? Would that be over a few weeks?
Well, normally it would be someone like we'd play a game and play a game on a Saturday or a Sunday. Then the next one would be a midweek game, maybe on a Wednesday night, and then back to a Saturday. So we're playing, probably we've gone for a minimum of 10 to 14 days.
Okay. It's a lot of hotel stays, basically.
A lot of hotel. But, you know, for most of the players, as far as I can remember, you knew that it was just part of your job. And, you know, and you had to train every day just like everyone else. You know, we used to train the next morning after a game, even just to keep loosened up. And then we'd jump on a plane. Well, once you get in the mainland, you're only 2 hours from there, an hour from there. So, and all the teams would let you use their training facility. So it might sound a little bit hard, but I don't remember it being that bad a deal. And I don't remember any players really complaining. We knew what we were walking into, you know.
Sure. What was downtime like in Hawaii then? Because I imagine the energy and the pace was a lot different to, let's do, or even just New York as an example.
Right. Well, you know, obviously we were in Oahu, which is where Waikiki is. Mm. And Waikiki is right down there on the front there. So it was just great. And being a British player, most of the British players, they had people, family come and visit them. You know, people coming from England and coming from all over. So you would take them down to Waikiki, and it's more of a tourist area. But once we've been there a couple of months, you start going to all the places the tourists don't go.
Yeah.
You know, there's other places that it was used to be called the north side. The south side is the Waikiki. The north side is where the north beaches are, where the people go surfing and stuff like that. So you find yourself becoming a little bit like one of the locals.
Yeah,
and getting, you know, the places to go. But Waikiki is a huge tourist area. It was great just to take family or friends down there and kind of show them what it was all about. And we had to be careful. Being players, you had to make sure that you still did your job. So you couldn't get caught up in just being one of the tourists. You had to still do the business.
Sure. And I guess even more so when halfway through the season, you become player coach. So what led to that happening?
I got along well with Vogelsanger, even though he was German, he was true German, he was a taskmaster, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And some of the players didn't like the way he handled himself. The British players handled him okay because we've been used to all that before. Well, I didn't realize there was stuff going on behind the scenes, but I get called up to Wardley's suite at the top of the hotel. And I'm thinking, what have I done? I've not broke curfew. I've not done nothing wrong. So I'm wondering why I'm getting called up there. So I got up there and the general manager and Wardley sitting there and they said, we're going to relieve Hubert. We're not happy with Hubert. And we want you to take over the team. I'm 29 at that time.
Yeah.
And the lesson learned here, for you two boys, lesson learned here. I said, let me think about it. I said, if I can get the support of the players, I'll be only too glad to think about it. And Wardley jumped right down my throat. He says, we don't ask them for permission for you to be the coach. We tell them. And I went, So the first thing I did was I went down to Hubert Vogelsanger's room. And I said, Hubert, I don't know what's going on with you people, but they've offered me the job. I said, I don't want you to think I went behind your back or anything like that, but this, I don't know. I'm just telling you what's happened. And he turned and said, Charlie, take it. He says, if you don't take it, somebody else will, and they might not like you.
Right. Yeah.
So I, that kind of, so I went straight back upstairs to Wardley, and I just said, what a, to be a privilege to take over the team for the, I think with 10 games left in the season. And I said, I'll look forward to it. And I don't know, you can look at the record, but one of the boys from West Ham was Tommy Taylor, who I really rated a good player. Mm-hmm. And I went to Tommy. I said, Tommy, I want you to be my captain and stick with me here and let's put the, make this thing happen. So I got a hold of the British boys and said, I need your help here. We're going to have to make this happen. And they come through like a house on fire. So it was all about just playing football and taking care of business.
That was something I was going to ask, actually, because there was quite a strong contingent of not just English-based players, but West Ham players, right. sort of like four or five who had gone on loan for that duration. I was going to ask, was there any ever any question of their mentality or desire? Did they always have half their heart back in West Ham, for example, where they weren't committed? But from what you said there, that didn't seem to be the case.
I'm trying to think. I know it was Patsy Holland and Tommy Taylor, and then there was another right-back, Keith somebody, and a goalkeeper. And I tell you what, the boys were brilliant. I'll tell you what, we call them the West Ham boys, but they were professionals. They didn't come there for a holiday, even though they had a bit of a holiday. Yeah. And what I liked about it was they all brought their wives. You know, one time some players used to come over and not bring their family, but they all brought their wives with them. So it made them more of a family affair. And like I said, I did approach the four of them and said, hey, I need your help here. Because, you know, and they were brilliant at training sessions and stuff like that. And the American players, I got their support as well. So it was a great introduction for me into coaching. But basically, all I did was what I was doing before as a captain, just getting the players together. I think we played more eight-a-side than we did before because everybody liked to play five-a-side, eight-a-side. Right. So I was able to do all the things with the players that I know the players liked rather than doing a five-mile run down the beach. That wasn't what I fancied.
Yeah. So I've been to Hawaii. It's not necessarily searing heat, but it's humid and very tropical. Like you'd be wet through doing a run like that, I can imagine.
Right, that's right. And we played all the games at night. So, I used to have them train in the afternoon, late afternoons, at the same conditions. So we didn't go out in the middle of the day where it was nice and warm or nothing like that. Mm. I wasn't into that. I tried to make them play under the same conditions that we were going to play under. So it was it wasn't bad at night, you know, when the sun went down. I can remember. I don't remember anybody fainting or, you know, drinking a lot of water or stuff like that. During the day, the AstroTurf used to get really warm because we had to play on AstroTurf. Right. But that's why I didn't want the players training during the day on that hot AstroTurf because it would hit the AstroTurf and then the heat would just bounce right back at you.
Right. Were you disappointed that it wasn't able to continue there? Would you have been quite happy to spend more time there had it not disbanded?
I'd have liked to have seen them stay there because I think it would have grown. But I think, I know for a fact that the league didn't like it. It was a travel nightmare for all the other teams. You know, I think it was 20 teams in the league at that time. Yeah. And they were all saying, this Hawaii thing's just a joke to fly all the way over there for one game and then come back again. So I think it was more of a league decision than a Wardley decision.
Okay. So, and then what that leads to is that franchise, if you like, becoming Tulsa Roughnecks. And for whatever reason, you're the only person that follows the team along there. Was that part of the fact that because you had such a close relationship with the ownership, or did it just seem the best idea at the time?
Well, when they found out the team was going to go to Wardley was keeping half the team and they sold the other half the team to a bread company in Tulsa.
Okay.
So when that was already established, they already picked a coach, and the coach was Bill Foulkes, the ex-Manchester United. He was in the plane crash. You know that. Like anyway, when we went to the soccer bowl, which I was still with the team of Hawaii that time, we went to the soccer bowl. Bill Foulkes was there. Well, I had played. Bill Foulkes was the manager of the Chicago team. Hmm. So he said, "I've been given the Tulsa job." And I said, brilliant, Bill. He says, how's it working out for you? And I just said, I had a great time. I said, I took over the team. He said, I know you took over the team. What do you want to do from here, Charlie? And I goes, I don't want to coach. I said, I'm too young to be a coach. So I'd like to keep playing. He said, well, I'd like to bring you to Tulsa and you can be my assistant. Now, all the things I've told you, how I've been very, very lucky and very, very fortunate. I'm going to be the assistant to Bill Foulkes of Man United. You know, Matt Busby, Man United, Bill Foulkes. So it was another great opportunity for me to come to Tulsa, be a player, assistant coach. So I was in, and Bill had too many contacts all around the league. He really didn't fancy any of the other players because half the West Ham guys all went back again. Sure. A couple of German guys went back. So apart from some of the American players, there was nothing else there, really. I'd sat down with him and basically said, there's really nothing for you to pick up. You'd be as well picking the player that you want rather than getting a player that just because he came in the suitcase, you know?
Yeah.
So I had a conversation with Bill before that. So that worked out, that I knew I was coming. I knew what I was going to be doing. And it was right perfect for me to be an assistant with who I thought was one of the biggest stars in, you know, English football at one time and a great legend. I actually, you know, when the season was over, it was in September, we didn't actually move till January. You know, I knew that the Tulsa thing was happening, but there was no good moving there because there was no stadium, there was no management team, there was no, Bill Foulkes was still living in Chicago. So it was, I had to wait 4 months, which was nice because, you know, you could enjoy the environment, the Waikiki and the beaches and stuff like that, where previously you never really get into it. You became a tourist all of a sudden. And that's when I learned to play golf. There was no other players there. I was the only player left there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, it had been a military base. There's a lot of military people there. They let me play on the military golf courses, and the freckles get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Hey, I can imagine. Did your time at Tulsa Roughnecks as a player cross over with the indoor leagues at all?
Yeah, we did play in that indoor league as well. When we finished the season, we had the indoor league as well, which I happened to like as well. Some players didn't like it. Some players thought the hard surface. But I like to play football. You could play it off the wall. You could play 1-2s. I think it made some of the players better players. I really do.
Was the indoor league still 11-a-side?
No, it was... I'm not too sure. I think it was seven. Okay. Six outfield players and a goalkeeper.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Did you find you were doing most of the defensive work, doing all the running around at the back?
That's right. Well, you, I mean, you end up being a sweeper. You don't be a left back in the indoor. You'd be a sweeper, last man in defence or whatever it was. Or every now and again, you go up and have a poke at the goal because it's not that far away. You know, every now and again, every defender just wants to have one or two pokes at the goal, you know, just for nothing else. So it was... But it was fast. It was entertaining. Goalkeepers didn't like it because, you know, they were bombarded because the ball was kind of flying at them all the time, you know. And it's a smaller goal, but at the same time, was it? But it was entertaining. I tell you what, fans liked it.
Yeah, it must have been a different atmosphere to the outdoor games.
I mean, you know, it was like ice hockey or football. You know what I mean?
I bet you scored so many more goals.
not me personally, but you know, your scores would be something like 12-8, and it was good for the fans. I mean, it was entertaining, and I'm sure we all played football. You got a lot of touches on the ball. No, yeah, I could play in an outdoor game and maybe touch the ball 10 times in a whole half. This is where the game goes. But on the indoor, no matter what position you're playing, you're getting touches on the ball all the time, just like playing in a gymnasium. So, me personally, a lot of players didn't like it. Physical players liked it. The non-physical players didn't like it because you could rattle them quite a bit.
Yeah, I imagine. You do one season as a player there at the Roughnecks before going to the next season at Toronto Blizzard. What was the situation there? How did that unfold?
Well, once again, you know, this coaching, you know, inevitable, they're going to get fired. And Bill Foulkes, for some reason, he got let go. I resigned as assistant coach because I was awful upset that they let Bill go.
Sure.
So I resigned as assistant coach. And then Alan Hinton, he came on board, for he was with Derby County. He came on board and I didn't fancy him. I don't think he fancied me. Well, as it would be, football players all know each other. I mentioned Keith Eddie, who played for Sheffield United, was also the captain of New York Cosmos. Well, he gets the head coaching job of Toronto Blizzard. And the first person, he called me up and said, hey, I'm looking for an assistant coach. Are you interested? So let me go from the cold weather to the warm weather to back up to the cold weather again. Because Toronto's north of Rochester, and Rochester's freaking cold. So I know Toronto's going to be cold. So that's how that happened, that Keith Eddy called me up and said, I would interested in bringing you up here as an assistant coach and a player. And I said, I'm in. I mean, I like Tulsa. I like the area. I like the people. They were so friendly, but you just got to follow your dream, and you have to make a living for your family. So that was how I ended up in Toronto for the Toronto Blizzard, which happened to be owned by a Canadian television station that had strong ownership in Toronto. And then they moved to the CNA Stadium, which is a big stadium up there in Toronto. So I'm kind of moving around quite a bit, but it all seemed to be good moves. You know, nothing was going downhill as far as I was concerned.
I have small knowledge that Canada has quite a good soccer scene. Was their culture different from playing in, for example, Tulsa or Hawaii?
Yeah, it was much different. You know, it was like New York. You had a lot of European and foreign fans that knew the game. In Tulsa, example, very small. There was very few foreigners in Tulsa. It wasn't a foreign. But you go to New York, you go to Toronto, you've got people from every country in the world who all love to play soccer. So we had quite an international. The people that came to these games knew the game. They understood the game. And that was good for us too. We liked that. And it was good to see the response we got from the media, and a great response from, because we had fun, you know, German, Italian, South American, British. It was a great mixture.
You say a mixture. You're one of six Scots in that squad. Did that bring you any home comforts?
When I got there, Keith kind of gave me the okay to find some Scottish players, and then he picked up another couple of English players who actually came from Sheffield United as well. Right. And so I think it was about 10 British boys on the squad. And it was a great environment. I mean, we lost the first five or six games, and then we won 10 in a row and made the playoffs. So it was a great place to play football or play soccer. The team was a good environment. Keith was a good coach. I've heard stories that the British guys come over for a holiday. I had never, ever ran across that with players that I've played with. All the players were all dedicated, and you know, they wanted to win the games.
You said in Team Hawaii, you really liked it when the British boys would bring over their wives. When you moved over to America, what was your own relationship status?
I was single, and then 3 years later, I married an American girl and had two children by her. So I became Americanized, in other words. You know, I made up my mind this is where I was going to be staying. So that's why I wanted coaching and why I wanted to make a future here. There was no way I was going to go back. You know, you all love our country, and there was no way I couldn't. Scotland and Great Britain was great to me. Great education got me where I was. And then, fortunately, I remarried again, and here I am in Florida. So we're still playing the fairy tale.
It's very interesting because sometimes when we do this podcast, we speak to other players and they're like, oh, I started to miss my family a bit or home comforts. But it really sounds like you made a home for yourself. So it makes a lot of sense that obviously, you know, you had children out there and, you know, you fell in love twice over. And like,
That was it. You know, I actually, to take a story a little deeper, I was an only child. So when I came to Tulsa, my mom and dad, they moved over here. My dad was a welder on the shipyards, and he wanted to come and join his son and watch his football career. So he came over here, they came over here. Obviously, they've passed away now, but they spent their golden years watching me play and seeing the success that went with it. So that's a good memory as well.
I'm glad they got to enjoy that. And to really see that, I think that's really important.
Well, that's what we all strive for as parents, and make sure that I always used to say, I want them to be better than I was. No matter what we do, I want them to be more successful than me and go from that. So that's just a goal. But once again, the fairy tale continues.
Now, what comes first, Charlie? Retirement after Toronto Blizzard, or are you offered to be head coach back at Tulsa Roughnecks? But does one inform the other?
When we had a pretty good season, it was the Blizzard. The season was over, and Keith got a call from Tulsa asking if he would make me available to talk to them in regards to the head coaching job. And Keith, obviously being a good pal of mine, said, I don't want you to go, but I can't stop you, so go ahead and talk to them. At the time, I had already bought a house in Tulsa when I was there the first time. I really liked the Oklahoma community, the Tulsa community. So when they offered me the job, I knew it was going to be like everything else. You're putting everything on your plate here, because coaching is a tough thing to do. You can't please everybody. So when they offered me the job, once again, I said, I'm in. I knew I had a home. I liked the people there. I had a really good following when I was a player there. So I was walking into something that I knew what I was walking into. And I was glad to take the job and give up my playing career and be a full-time manager.
And how did you enjoy that experience that time around?
I loved it. I mean, I liked the challenge. I still young enough to, you know, I could work with the players and stuff like that. But it was a bigger challenge than even I imagined. Trying to keep the players happy, trying to keep the management happy, trying to get results. You know, it's like just like you watch every day in the Premier League, you know. It's a challenge. Every day is a challenge. There's always going to be someone that's going to walk in your dressing room or a player is going to make it balls up something. You just don't know. So you're at the mercy of everybody. A manager's job, it's like an octopus. You've got so many legs to it that people don't realise how big a job it can be. So I enjoyed it. We made the playoffs and I did well the first year. But just like everything else, you've got to please the management. And unfortunately, the manager and I had words and it just didn't work out.
Between that and based on what you said a lot around head coaches moving and being fired or falling out with the ownership, was that just maybe the American view of the sport at the time, very kind of immediate results that they were looking for?
Joe, you hit it right on the nail on the head there. Everybody wanted quick results. Nobody wanted a build program or I've got some players that I think we're going to go. And that's what happened to me, basically. The general manager wanted to move a couple of players out and bring some new players in. And I stood up for my guns and said, these boys are good boys. Once we can get going, we're going to get some results. And obviously, a general manager has got a bigger word with the owners than a coach. So he won and I lost. And I just stayed in Tulsa. I mean, I had an opportunity to go coaching for the Buffalo Stallions, which was in the indoor league at that time. And I was quite happy to try and get into the business world in Tulsa.
It's funny you mention it, because from what I can see, you really not just set up camp in Tulsa and Oklahoma, but really kind of became a familiar name in the place. I mean, the Charlie Mitchell's restaurant, in trying to get hold of you, I found a lot of reminiscing online on Facebook about the restaurant and how much of a destination for people in Tulsa. And was that set up not long after you finished up as manager?
Well, actually, you know, a guy came and saw me and said, would you want to be my partner at a restaurant while I was still coaching? Okay. And I said, sure. Just like a lot of players did with pubs back home. You know, they all bought a pub, but they weren't really in the pub. So it was in the progress. And I think that was one of the things that upset the general manager, that I was kind of looking to my future. And rightly so. Maybe he was right. Maybe I was trying to pull too many things in at the one time. But long story short, the fan base was really good with me. I had a great fall on the fan base. So I thought, why not take the advantage of having the people that follow you, open up a restaurant and see if they'll follow you all the way to the restaurant. And as it turned out, it was a huge success. So, you know, it was one of these things again that I landed on my feet again. Didn't know the restaurant business, but I knew the people business. And somebody else could cook it and I'll shake hands and smile.
What food did you serve? I'm quite curious to know.
It was like a Scottish English pub, fish and chips, pie, shepherd's pie. And then we threw in a few hamburgers in there and a few salads and then chicken meals. And so it was more of a good pub atmosphere, but what a restaurant touch to it. You know what I mean? It wasn't like the big bar or nothing like that, but it was British food. It was a kind of British menu that we started off with and just kind of progressed from there.
Beyond that, though, in Oklahoma, you also, I imagine you did quite a lot of coaching until your retirement, right? Whether that was in college level or soccer schools. You must have been the face of youth soccer, I guess, in the area. Like, you must be familiar to so many people.
Well, that's what happened was, you know, as well as being in the restaurant business, I wanted to help with the youth program. I was big and strong in the youth program. So I get involved with all the Tulsa youth programs and I coached a couple of teams and I did a lot of clinics. And we call them clinics or you could call them camps or whatever you want to call them. So yeah, I was very, very popular in the Tulsa community. You know, did charity events, anything we could just to keep our name and keep the restaurant busy. And, you know, you kept yourself in the news as much as you could, you know, especially doing charity dinners for people, help people out, you know, anything you could do to keep the pot boiling. And then eventually, after the restaurant business, I really, really enjoyed it. I go over to a college in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, and a university. And I coached there for 10 years, bringing in British players and to amalgamate with the American player. And that was a big success for me, with having the British players come over and mix with the American players. And I'm telling you, boys, the British players did fantastic, and the American boys loved it, because now they could hang out with the British players, and they could, you know, that made them feel like they were part of part of the game. Because British players in America, to these boys, they were the bee's knees, you know that. And the British boys that came over, most of the boys that I've got come over from London, I mean, they were brilliant with American boys. They trained hard, they played hard, so they were a good example to the American lads, like, if you want to make it, you better do the business, or else you're not going to play.
Charlie, it's been amazing to speak with you. Hope we haven't eaten too much into your what would have been your golf time today on the course.
Like I said before, and I can do to help promote the sport, but you boys have made it really easy. You're very relaxing to talk to. So I think it's been a good deal for everybody. And I thank you for finding me. I'm just glad you're not the IRS or
we'll beat that part out.
Phil, don't you worry about that. But yeah, no, it's been a delight to give us an insight onto all of your career experience, but Team Hawaii especially, which is just this extraordinary little moment in US soccer history that we're fascinated by, and I think a lot of other people will be as well. So
thank you so much,
Charlie.
Cheers, boys. Cheers.
We did it, Scully. We got, and it was everything I hoped. I had such a great time speaking with him. I don't know why. Obviously, was really appreciative that people cared about the story and the effort to get hold of him, and he enjoyed telling it as well.
Most definitely. And I would love to see a movie made on the life he's lived. Like,
is that all your questions about Hawaii answered?
Probably, yeah. Mm. Like, because from what he said, I believed every word.
Yeah, so it happened. Like,
yeah. So it happened. That's it. Like, no, we have definitive proof that, you know, it was a well-to-do football club. So yeah, I'm happy with that. I mean, there's other stuff I'd probably want to ask, but this is good enough.
And I hope you guys enjoyed it, especially those that had a similar curiosity for Team Hawaii off the back of this podcast as we did, because it was definitely a team that got mentioned a lot in some of the correspondence that we had and the messages. It was just like, what the hell is that about? We need to find out more. Well, there you go. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as kind of hinted at by Scully, we will keep going. We've done a sort of solid 10 that we wanted to for the first season. I think you just get some sporadic ones until we arrive with another block. Because, you know, outside will be opening up soon. I think the Zooms will be drying up. We're anticipating that a bit, I think. But yeah, I think there's a lot of people still want to speak to. We've tried really hard to speak to a couple of women that we wanted to speak to about their experiences in their career, because there was a time where abroad was the only really sustainable place to have your career as a woman playing football. So that's something we still want to do. We've spoken to a Scot now, finally. I want to speak to more. I want to speak to some Welsh players as well. People who've played for Royal Antwerp from Manchester United, people that went from Chelsea to Vitesse. We spoke with, on the last episode, Cam Melling and I, we spoke about players that have played in South America. There's not a massive amount of players that have been over. But yeah, Neil Kennedy got in touch about George Saunders and his career. And there's a link to a Guardian piece. Thank you, Neil. But there's still a lot more things to do, a lot more legendary players, a lot more current players. And yeah, we're gonna drop in now and then, give you a little sprinkle of stuff.
Some one-offs, some might barely fit the brief.
Yeah, because
it might be interesting.
We're now getting the opportunities to speak with a lot of players that don't necessarily fit inside the remit of this podcast and the theme. But if we feel like doing it, because it's our podcast and our rules, we might just do it anyway, put it on the feed, call it a little bonus chat or something. Yeah, we'll see. Tell us what you would like to see at INTL Clearance. Or that email again is intlclearance@gmail.com. But before we go, Scully.
Yes, sir.
We've got time for one more game.
Oh, wow. All right, let's go.
Putting you on the spot.
I wasn't ready for this. I wasn't prepared.
Good. It's another manager one. I'll start nicely for you because I'm feeling generous. Roy Hodgson with 12 overseas jobs. For those who don't know, this is a higher or lower game. Scully's got to guess if their jobs overseas as a coach were higher or more than the previous name. So we're starting with Roy Hodgson at 12. Your time starts now. Bobby Williamson, higher or lower?
Lower.
Correct, with three. Peter Taylor, higher or lower than three?
Higher.
Incorrect, you've got two. Eddie Newton, higher or lower than two?
Higher.
Incorrect, one.
Wow.
Graham Souness, higher or lower than one?
Higher.
Correct, you managed three. Bobby Robson, higher or lower than three?
Let's go higher.
Correct, that's four. Terry Venables, higher or lower than four?
Lower.
Correct, with two. You went over there, but I'm going to allow it.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing that, because I think I really started to hit my stride at the end there. Started just dismally. I was a bit scared, yeah, but I think I might have just equaled my total.
Started, so I finished. No, you got three.
Oh.
You've definitely done better than that. You definitely got into fives and sixes.
It's been a long day. Like I said, I wasn't mentally prepared. I wasn't really ready. I'm hoping you guys don't just judge me on that performance. I'm ready to come back in the next season and get straight back to work.
Yeah, and you'll have to do better the next time we're on. When that is, we're not sure. It may yet still be next week, by the way. We're just going to see how it goes. I'm just trying to give myself a breather here, and we'll get back to you. But yeah, thank you for everyone that's been listening, and we really hope you enjoyed that Charlie Mitchell one. Hopefully that was worth the wait. If there's anyone you think we should be speaking to, any other weird spells, weird jobs abroad, get in touch. We love it all. And yeah, we look forward to speaking with you again very, very soon. I've been Joe Walker.
I've been Scully.
And that was another edition of International Clearance.